The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Roger talks about billions in ag tech, but does he make it? Jennifer measures risk with metrics and a sharp stick. Another pitch pours it on, but will it be a strikeout? More fraud, spies, and lies, and a new segment, How Do They Do That? You can only find out on The Cyber Show. Or can you? Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
Welcome to The Cyber Show. Puck, introduce yourself. Give us your name, name of your company, what you do.
Thank you, Fred. I'm Puck Fernson. I am the founder of Guru Global, and that's our website. And we're bringing to market the world's first universal attaching stroller mirror. And then we are building an AI-driven technology platform for gift giving on the back end.
All right. Well, that was right at the edge of how much I'll tolerate for you to tell me about your company before I interrupt you. So it was a good job to stop at that point in time. So I just have to ask, Guru Global sounds like it's something completely different than what you do. So you know what a guru is, right? It's supposed to be a teacher, an educator who's well-respected and so forth. And that's not anything like your business, right?
Well, with the mirror, the number one thing most parents don't know, face-to-face communication is the number one thing for brain development for their children. And I've done focus groups and surveys, and you ask parents, and they're like, well, I don't know what the number one thing is, because there's all this different information out there. And so we're going to try to get that message out to everybody and put these mirrors on all the strollers that are in the United States.
All right, I just have to ask, you have a slightly different accent when you say mirrors. I say mirrors. You seem to say with it like more of an A. Where are you from that you have that slightly different accent?
I am just out of the Boston area, and I've heard that when I'm talking to people outside of Boston, so I've got to work on that. Mirror is how you say it?
Well, Boston, right? You're from Boston Yard, right?
Right. I'm a Virginian by birth, but I've been here long enough that there you go. So, the accent.
Yeah, well, so it doesn't matter where you're from or how you talk. We're fine with it. I just want to make sure when you say mirror that they understand it's something that you see your mom's face in as she strolls you around, or your father's face, or if it happens to be your grandfather, because I just had a granddaughter in the last couple of days.
Congratulations.
Absolutely. So if your grandfather is strolling you around and you can see your grandfather in the mirror and your grandfather can see you in the mirror, it makes you both smile, right?
Yes. The kids, first time I put it in front of kids that weren't my own kids, I didn't know what would happen. And the kids just lit up because they were like, oh, look, you're paying attention to me. So yeah, kids love it too.
Do you have something that makes it so it looks like I'm paying attention even if I'm not?
Yes. It's a big convex mirror. So the kids just, they're happy to see you, and don't be back there smoking cigars or anything, but otherwise it's going to be good to go.
Oh, so now I have to behave good all the time. I can't wait till they turn their back and then, you know, do whatever bad things. All right, well, there you go. So you start with the mirror, and the mirror, you know, we're on the radio, so we can't see what the mirror looks like. So but it's big. And I get, is it like a convex mirror? So you see a lot?
Yes, a large convex mirror. And one of the things that was hard, it's one of our trade secrets, is we have anti-glare technology on the mirror. And for all the good that a mirror does, keeping kids attached to their parents, you burn or blind one baby, the game's over. And so we made sure to spend time prototyping to get that anti-glare technology on it.
So you guarantee that it won't burn or blind any baby?
That's right. It had to be a safe mirror. Wouldn't come to market without anything that wasn't high quality and safe.
No burning or blinding. Okay. So, but that convex thing, I have to tell you, you know, those of us that are sensitive about our weight, the convex mirror makes us look wider. Can you make one that makes us look taller and thinner instead and still gives you the big view?
That's a great question. I think the baby's going to like the wideness. They find it humorous and enjoy it. But that's a great question. We'll look at that for the next version.
Yeah, I'm saying, you know, 25% more. I think you get people to pay 25% more for a thinning mirror. And the other thing, the really good trick would be if the baby sees you as being thin and tall, but you can see the baby realistically. If there's a way to make a mirror that, depending on where and how you look at it, it looks different, that's even better. And of course, that's a technical challenge. All right, moving right along to the important part. So you sell the mirror, and however you sell the mirror, that doesn't make you a ton of money, but it makes some money, right? So now they're buying the mirror, and what is it that then causes them to say, aha, I'm going to send you a lot more money?
So once parents come on to our platform...
Wait a minute. How are they going to get, I see the mirror. How does the mirror get me onto your platform?
So when they see the mirror, what we've found is that parents will go up to somebody who's pushing a child in a mirror because came out of the Harvard iLab engineers, and it says Guru really big on the back. And they say, where did you get that mirror? And why do you have that mirror? And it's, if you study why do products go viral, that public usage of a product is one of the reasons. And okay, so then they'll come to our website.
But you don't have the URL guru, GOORU.com. You have guruglobal.com. Does somebody else have Guru?
Yes.
Ah, okay. So the branding. So how much is it going to cost you? How many arms and legs is it going to cost you to get that other one, guru.com?
I think it's going to just be easier for us to add the global onto the mirror.
No, you already have that. I'm just, oh, you're going to put Guru Global. Oh, interesting. Or you could go with guru.co, right? Or something like that. All right. But I'm going to solve your technical problem separately. All right. So they go to the website because they love the mirror and they want one. And that's the only place they can get it, right?
Correct.
At least until you're in retail, right?
Yes. And we have retail set up. I would like to put it in North America, the ISN retail is the distributor is called Brixie. And I really like those people. They've got stores in Beverly Hills and Michigan Avenue and locations that I think are good for starting the trend with the mirror, because ultimately we want to see this on every stroller in the country. And so we could start in those retailers.
You're looking at, you know, you have patents and such, and you're looking at licensing it to the stroller companies?
Yes. And so we have a patent for mirrors and technology, and we also have a patent coming for the addition and attachment and integration of mirrors onto strollers, because we want this as a licensable opportunity.
Excellent. All right. So, and I can imagine now you're going to have 25 mirrors on the stroller, so everywhere the baby looks, they're looking behind them, and then they'll get eye problems. Okay, we got to be careful about that. Let's talk about, they come to your website, and then what happens?
Then what we're building on the back end is a way to understand the psychodemographics of the individuals. And
Hang on. Psychodemographics. Okay, that sounds dangerous. So tell us, what is a psychodemographic?
One way that I can explain this, in our schools, we measure three things. We measure reading and writing as one. We measure math. And we measure something called bodily kinesthetic intelligence, which is how well somebody can move, or athletes, or dancers. But there's all these other ways that somebody can be intelligent. And we want parents to understand that about their child. What is my child's unique intelligence? And then we're going to use the artificial intelligence to scan the whole world of gifts. So as that child gets older, every birthday, every holiday, we'll have the perfect gifts delivered based on that psychology of the child, the demographic of the child, and the interests of the child.
Okay, so you're helping parents who voluntarily say, look, I'm willing to tell you what I see in my child and how they look to me and what they do and how they behave, so you can find better gifts for me. And so you're going to help them in figuring out what the gift is. I know that we have horrible problems in finding gifts for our grandchildren, which, you know, we seem to do a lot more because we have more children and grandchildren now as we get older. So when you do that, you know, maybe the parents suggest, oh, here's a couple of things, right? How about grandparents? Can grandparents do this? And then can grandparents get it? Can you maybe make it so that you don't know the actual name of the child? You don't have any personal information about the child. You just have the demographic information?
That's a great question. Right now, we're thinking it's just people who self-select into this. One thing I found when I started to talk to people about the business model people would say, well, I am a terrible gift giver, and, or I am someone who really appreciate gifts and I take forever to do it. And so yes to the question about grandparents. We want ultimately grandparents to have the same benefits and ability to both get the perfect gifts and to give the perfect gifts. You're a technology genius, and so you might have some ideas on how we could get this to be something that is above board, is people self-selecting, but also helping people in a larger way to be better gift givers.
Well, I appreciate the positive comment, but as my brother said when we were very young, said, don't applaud, just throw money. Having said that, your information on your company is available at thecybershow.co. They'll be able to go there during the week of your show and click through to your company, look at the G-Wiz if they're accredited investors.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. Just pull a double. Papers flying, everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their G-Wiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Brought to you by Sleep. Or the lack thereof. Breaking news on the Cyber Show. Online reporting of school shootings is way down. So is online reporting of war, insurrection, and global climate change. In fact, I have received no online reporting of any bad things for the last 24 hours. Of course, my internet connection has been down, so maybe that's breaking news on the Cyber Show.
David Zenzian, you know, thanks for joining today on the Cyber Show. You've been in this industry for a long time, like I have, right? When you look back at the beginnings, how did you get into it? How did all this start? What horrible mistakes did you make that led down this crazy path?
It wasn't really mistakes. It's a funny thing is, I was talking to an old high school friend recently, and you know, this is like high school back in the 80s, high school. This is like, you know, just after the Commodore, the Apple wasn't really a thing yet. Time frame.
The Gremlin was still a car. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're like, we knew you'd always be in technology. So it's just something that I knew I would always be in technology. My dad was an electrical engineer, mechanical engineer. I always had an affinity toward computers. It just always was a natural thing for me. But being as I, like you live on the water now, I lived in a boat all through high school and there wasn't much space. You know, having space for a computer wasn't something to have. In fact, computers back in the 80s weren't easily got. So we had one of those. Remember the old Radio Shack computers? You'd fold the keyboard off the front.
Oh, yeah. RS-80s were there? Yeah.
I have to look up which one was, but that's what we had on the boat. And that's what I first learned. And naturally, because there's so few things to do on it, the first thing I learned to do was be able to connect to bulletin boards around the world. And naturally, I didn't want my parents getting upset with me for long-distance phone calls, so I found ways of making that happen. So that was my first foray into really getting online. So I was in the East Coast. And, you know, naturally want to communicate with people in Europe and the West Coast and just be part of those communities. And it's where I first learned of a community of people like me. And because honestly, I had nobody in high school who did technology. In fact, I have one friend I knew from my class who actually went off to do programming. He did really well for himself. But honestly, there was really no one in my class. When I first started in College of Charleston, I think there were 13 computer science majors. And like that was all 4-year program. That was all 4 years. There were 13 of us. Now, when I left, there were like 130 in the first year class. So it's
over those 4 years.
Yeah. So it's changed enormously as we've seen. But I've always been really interested in how things work. And I guess that's kind of the hacker mentality, if you want to call it that. But I've always really been interested in the bits and pieces of breaking them down to the smallest parts. And it did start with that phishing, you know, how does a phone lines work? How do call centers work? How do a phone PBXs work? So naturally my first job out of college, I worked on AS400s, Microvaxes and phone systems. So it was actually a small shipping company that was actually from Wilmington to Jacksonville. And it was just, you know, the ships that you go around, I worked in those ports. So I dealt with all the trucks and the terminals and the ports. And it to me, that was just common sense. Because in the South, there wasn't you know, you couldn't go out and get a job doing pen testing or a code review. No one did that. It just wasn't a thing.
Right.
And I just, I built up my life running and supporting systems, but I always had my little book I built up years ago.
Awesome. I love it. Hacker's Guide. You know, for you listening, it's a three-ring binder that says Hacker's Guide on the binding. It's awesome.
If you remember, like, when you got on bulletin boards, you had the original, the Hacker's Fact, you know, the 2600. This was, like, from years ago. Oh, here's, in fact, here's the Tandy part number on there for making a red box.
Awesome.
That was the way I learned my knowledge. I had to print out these tomes of things and read through it and get back online and do little things. And then I got into college and I started doing bulletin boards. So I actually ran a WWIV board and I got into programming by taking the source code and making it multi-line and doing hacks to it and extending the system to do what I wanted it to do. And I was actually pretty proud. People actually used the hacks, I made to it and making a multi-line board and actually tying it into both WWIVnet and FighterNet, which is, again, connecting multi-coasts. And I don't know if you remember the joys when you got that first 2400 HST modem. And you're like, ooh, it's so fast.
Well, I was actually a little late, to the networked world. I had, computers that I didn't connect to the bulletin boards and so forth. But that's, that's my path. But I love what you said, and that path too, right? That it's about systems of things. And it's not about, code. And it's not about, breaking code or anything else. It's about figuring out systems of things. And your first job was not just with computers, but with physical things moving around and processes and organizations that were picking them up and putting them down on time, systems in place.
Oh, right? Talk about on time. Those ships, if you like have a delay on those ships, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars per hour. It's
hour.
And you got to think about it. When a ship comes to port, it might have, 30,000 containers. You might be taking 500 off here and we have to put on, you have to account for the next four stops. If you balance it wrong, the ship could fall over. So you have to actually play. And the funniest thing about all of this, to me at least, is when I first joined the company, when the ship came into the port, they would sit down, they pull the whiskey out of their drawer. And this is an office where they'd still have whiskey in their desk and they still smoke at their desks. And they'd sit down and smoke their cigarettes and put index cards on the floor and organize the unloading and loading of ships. This is before we actually had programs to do all that.
Right.
So then they actually got a program on a MicroVax, which ran a database called Mumps, and actually just a large.
Yeah.
I made the mistake. I kept Mumps in my resume. People still call me about that. I shouldn't do that. But
you should do that. Definitely. Yes.
But no, it's the changing of things. It's shipping is one of the oldest industries in the world. And to think that it is just now in the last 15 or so years becoming really modernized, like the true modernization, like to the point of, they have RFID on containers as you're going in through ports. They're doing x-ray scans and actually scanning material, actually real modern ports. There's some really cool stuff I've seen coming out of Singapore and other global ports that I would love to be back in the shipping field. It's such a revolutionary field these days. The applications they're building, the tying together with satellites and ships and the coordination of all these things, it's a really intriguing field.
Oh, Chris, my goodness. Much to cover here. So first off, he was a phone freaker, right?
Right.
Right. So he's talking about all these tones. And for the audience that doesn't understand what he means, this was at that point in time, the signaling for the phone system went over the wires in an audio form in the same way as your voice went over it. So if you could put in the right tones, you could take control of various components of the switching network and do whatever you wanted. So, he was talking about looking up the tones. That's what he meant, right? Okay. So he was a phone freaker, and when he said how nicely he said it, making that happen for his long-distance phone calls, what he meant was, stealing it from the phone company. So, all right. Now, I personally never did that. I had, the prohibition on that in my world from the way I was brought up, but okay, fair enough. So the next thing he said that I thought was awesome was, awesome. He said he had no tech friends in high school.
Right.
Well, guess what, man? So as it turns out, in grade school, I went to the Falk School, which is affiliated with the University of Pittsburgh. And my father was a professor in physics. And so after school, I would go down the hill to the physics department, to my father's lab, instead of, you know, taking the bus home. And we'd, you know, sit there in the lab. And so I was brought up in the super high tech environment. So I ended up, you know, before I was even in high school, programming the computers in the physics lab for, you know, analysis of physics experiments. Yeah, I didn't have any other kids that were doing that with me, but a lot of the other kids at Falk School were also associated with, their parents were also professors at the university and other people at the university. So I ended up, you know, getting to know the kids from Project Solo, who were all, you know, programmer geek types, you know, and so I had the opposite experience, right? I had the experience of everybody I knew was in one way or another, you know, a physicist or an engineer's child, which is to say a hacker. Right.
The, you know, I love the fact you lived on a boat through high school too, right? You know, it's just, it's so much fun. You know, David's one of my boat friends. He follows along with all this stuff and lives in North Carolina on the Outer Banks. But, you know, that space constraint and all those constraints, you know, my childhood was more like David and didn't have a bunch of tech friends. My dad worked at IBM. And other than that, you know, there was just the kids in you know, doing this stuff on my own. But, I gotta have to ask, Mumps. I don't remember a database called Mumps. Did you run across that one?
I'm not sure I recognize the name Mumps. But I think he was talking about a BBS, right? The bulletin board system.
Right.
So it was the back end for the bulletin board system. So now I never ran a bulletin board system, but I used various bulletin board systems. But I ended up in the Usenet network and whatever was before that. But I was very fortunate that I ended up. So my brother was a student at Carnegie Mellon when I was in high school, and actually before that. So I ended up in the Carnegie Mellon, you know, computer science environment, and able to use their IBM mainframes and learning APL and so forth. So I missed a fair amount of the beginning of his experience with that. But on the other hand, AS400 and Microvax and phone systems, yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. AS400, by the way. It's called something else now, but that's the IBM mid-sized computer, right? That's after the Digital Equipment Corporation, you know, DEC early computers. And so he was some years after me, but I, you know, I recognize all these environments, you know, that he was going through. What a fun time that was when you had pieces of paper where you were doing everything and trying to transform that on your own into a program that made that process work.
Well, you know, and I love the shipping bit. Yeah, because I say David and I talk boats a lot, you know, and share the whole sort of logistics and adventure of that. But then, you know, working in shipping, right? You know, in Port Everglades, Fort Lauderdale, I just sailed through there. I watched a 1,000-foot container ship, you know, get tugged in next to me in the middle of the night. And the logistics of that, as I'm always saying in the cyber world, right, many of these things we've been doing for a long time. And in supply chain security, software bill of materials, all that stuff these days, you know, if what we're talking about is inventory and bills of material.
Yeah, inventory has been around forever, right?
Right.
The thing is, we just never did that.
With this.
Yeah.
But,
and the other thing about inventory is, remember, inventory is the basis for assessing value to things, right? So, you know, at the end of a year in a store, you go do an inventory and you have to report the differential in inventory on your taxes, right? And what's the current value of your inventory and such. And in the software space and the IT space for content data and so forth, that's not done. And that was one of the big problems in the legal arena with dealing with the value of the theft, right? So you went and stole the content. The first question they would ask is, well, where, you know, if it's gone, oh my goodness, how can you work without? No, we still have it. It's just that they stole it. No, wait a minute. Excuse me. That you said they stole it, but you still have it. So the whole legal construct of taking physical things rather than information just wasn't in place at that time. And, you know, until the first person, you know, ended up getting somebody mad enough to make it illegal.
Well, and it's not just, you know, that analog between the physical and the cyber, but, you know, you and I and David have lived through, you know, a fascinating set of eras on the physical side. You know, global containerized shipping wasn't a thing when we were all born. You know, it was.
Right. They didn't have all those. Yeah, those things that hook to each other and lock to each other that make that whole thing one big physical component.
Packets.
As opposed to stuff falling off and out and so forth, right?
Yeah, the longshoremen with hooks and bags and nets and so forth, as opposed to these, you know, massive container systems we're used to now, and UPC codes. You know, again,
universal product codes for those of you that code.
Yeah, barcodes, right? But I remember, yeah. I remember as a little kid, you know, going to the shopping with my mom and finding out the store was closed for inventory. It used to happen a lot. You know, try to imagine shutting down every business constantly to physically count things just so you don't know what you have. So
one of my best friends, when I was not, I wouldn't say that young, but he did an inventory, right? He and his wife would go and do inventory for, you know, shop after shop, and for even for department stores. They worked for an inventory company. And the way they did that, after you've done that so many times, you get so good at looking at something and recognizing that's an 8x4x6. The calculation's already built into your brain. You just write down the number and move on. You get extremely efficient at picking out inventory, you know, quantities of things in three-dimensional space by just knowing the multiplication of, you know, whatever the rows by columns by depth is. So fascinating. And that went away completely. That does not exist anymore.
Because you know, hiring friends like yours to do inventory was more efficient than doing it by yourself. So there's a whole business niche there. But that was so much less efficient than the way we do it now. You know, actually counting things all along the path. So you always know what your inventory is, that it's orders of magnitude. And that's the kind of changes in business, you know, that get interesting around this.
And the reordering process,
right.
The inventory control, reordering. And then that allows you to do the supply chain for real-time inventory control. So you do just in time. So you know when you have to buy it to have it before you run out of it, and reduce the inventory costs and also the shrinkage and all that. The thing is, that created this other brittleness, right? And that's why when that supply chain, when you get that too tight and one thing breaks somewhere, all of a sudden you can't make a car because some guy in a little shop, you know, outside of, you know, whatever, Ohio, they had a car breakdown, so they couldn't bring in the oil they needed to make some part that goes into 500,000 GM park, you know, cars, right? All of a sudden, the whole factory stops.
And it's a great example, though, of how you have to balance these things, right? Because on the one hand, if you want to, you say, I don't want to have a brittle system, I'm going to, you know, stockpile lots of stuff, I'm not going to do just-in-time manufacturing, and all your competitors do. And that's just, let me finish. You know, that's just the way things are. Then your costs will be much higher and you'll probably go out of business. So this is where policy needs to come in, because, you know, from a pure capitalist business competition perspective, you can say, no, I have to do just in time. From a national security and resiliency perspective, you may want to say, yeah, but, you know, we will give you tax incentives. We will put other policies in place. So even to level that playing field, right? So you can have some inventory in the system.
But this goes into what's called risk aggregation, right? What's happening here is you're piling too much consequence on something that's too small. So the way you reduce that is, you know, you just systematically introduce redundancy. So you don't only have one supplier of that critical part. You have to do the analysis and figure it out. And that's in the information technology space. It's the same as in that physical space, but the physical space has partly caught up to it, although the pandemic showed some weaknesses. But the information space is still ridiculous, right? There's no redundant library for, you know, Linux or, you know, Windows, right? There isn't a redundant set of all the things. So if this one breaks or gets vulnerable, you can just drop in the replacement. So we have this enormous interdependency problem in the cyber arena that's wrecking havoc, and that's what's causing major outages, major supply chain problems. And I don't think we're going to build redundant copies of all that software. I think we're just going to get to the real-time detection, analysis, mitigation.
Well, and this is something where I think of the supply chain world, both because of what it is and also because of some of the mechanisms we need to develop for that, may sketch solutions, right? In the early digital bill of materials, the DBOM days, you know, 2019, thinking about this, and then we had the pandemic start, you know, nationally, we did not know what our national stock of all the parts to make, you know, intubation systems and masks and so forth were. And I can see that as something where, you know, as a competitive thing between nations, you know, at some point in the not too distant future, you know, every country, the United States, should be able to say, here's, these are the critical things we need to keep the country running. Here's our national stockpile, including all the, you know, companies and private sector and so forth. And that information is handled well.
Yeah, but this goes in the category of lessons unlearned. Okay, let's talk about lessons unlearned, because it's happened before, right? World War II is the thing they point to in terms of going after the ball bearing factories in Germany, right? To take out, you know, the belly punch, whatever, the knock out their gut, all sorts of supply chain things in the military for a long time. And it happened again and again, you know, Taiwan for parts and so forth. And in the early 90s, critical infrastructure, we were, you know, we'd identified interdependencies that they did nothing about. And then Y2K, they re-examined everything, rewrote all sorts of programs before the flip over to Y2K at all. So we've got that covered. And that, no, it's not. And then same thing happened for the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, and then the second Gulf War. In this case, we were taking advantage of our understanding of that. And, okay, the same thing happened in the financial crisis having to do with mortgages. You see this all the time. Lessons unlearned. It's not that we don't know this as a society. It's not that it's not been published in books. It's not that it's not been taught in classes. It's that we just don't do the job professionally.
I think a lot of it, you know, is we understand that it should be done. However, either, you know, we're incapable of, or the cost is too high. And there's an interesting...
It's neither of those. It's priorities, right?
Maybe. We'll have to debate some of these on another segment, but you know, my last comment on this, there's an interesting thing I watched the other day looking at acid rain. And anybody that grew up in the 80s knows all about acid rain, because acid rain was completely out of control. It's not anymore. We've through all sorts of, you know, things we've done, acid rain is not, you know,
it's not a major problem anymore. Yeah.
It's gotten way better, right? You know, so yeah. But yeah, we probably going to have to approach something really closely to do something about it. But again, I think, nationally, we have not been able to maintain the information. You know, but I think we can now.
It's not a matter of ability. It's a matter of willingness. I do want to bring up one other thing about what David said, though, because I thought his hacker's guide, what an awesome thing.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Did you have a book or not have a book where you kept track of stuff?
I did not. No, I'm not good with that sort of thing, but I love it. Three-ring binder, I can totally see it, right?
Okay, you remember the movie Sneakers, right?
Yep.
And, you know, they're out in the truck, and he's trying to get past this lock, and he's looking through the book of how you get past that, and then he calls over the radio, right? And then Robert Redford.
Anybody remember how to defeat an electronic keypad?
Oh.
Don't even joke about that, Martin. Those things are impossible.
Think I'm joking? Looks like they just put it in.
Oh, boy.
Here, maybe this might help. An old buddy of mine who was in Desert Storm sent it to me. Of course, he was on the other side.
Come on, Kreese. There's got to be a way around these things.
All right. This might work.
Yeah. Yeah. Above. Yeah. Right. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'll give it a shot. That worked.
Kicks the door and it opens up. No problem. It's all, you know, masters of the universe, complex, figure it all out. Oh, we got it here. Kick the door. Okay. That worked. So I used to have all this on a little computer in my pocket, and I kept it online. You know, even in the early days, I had it on a disc. I never wanted that on pieces of paper because there's so much of it.
But
I understand pieces of paper, especially if you don't want, you know, somebody who steals your computer or breaks into your computer to, you know, be able to take advantage. All right, we'll move on.
How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. 1. We know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. 2. We know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. 3, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. 4, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And 5, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Roger Royce is one of the most well-known and well-positioned attorneys working on cyber issues, particularly in the ag tech arena, but also in many other areas. He also has a tremendous understanding of influence and related issues, as we'll see in our discussions.
Welcome back, Roger. It's great to see you again. Long time no see is what I usually say, but that probably doesn't apply. So we've been talking about the ag space and the technology space. Now, you're a lawyer, and you do legal work for all of these companies. How much do you understand about the technology components of it, and how important is understanding the technology versus understanding everything else in terms of being successful in the ag tech space and the high-tech evolution it's going through?
Well, you're right. I'm a lawyer. I'm not a technologist or a technical person. I'm a corporate lawyer, so I tend to be industry agnostic. It doesn't really matter. I mean, I do the same stuff for these companies as a general rule. However, I think I do understand the tech. I understand the markets. I understand where it's come and where it is now, and I have a good idea where it's going. And that can be pretty useful to my clients. In fact, I have VCs that will call me from time to time and say, hey, have you heard of this company? What do you think of them? You know, would you invest in them?
And now you obviously can't reveal client confidential information, but what bounds you in terms of giving that sort of advice? And do people hire you specifically for investment advice?
No, for legal advice. I'm a lawyer and I have to stay in my lane, and I'm going to, although I know. I mean, and what kind of strikes me, though, it's in this valley, people get seduced by technology. And I can tell you, I understand the technologies in a lot of areas of ag tech, and it's not the best mousetrap that gets funded. This is going to be controversial. People out there are going to argue with me. It's just not.
Well, let's be really clear. The best technology essentially never wins, right? And we face this, you know, angel eggs that we help grow companies, right? So we face technologists all the time that have this stuff. And the worst thing is when you have an engineer or a scientist running a company and they don't have business experience and they don't recognize and understand the value of sales and marketing, the value of, you know, intellectual property, everything else, right? How to run a company. So tell us about, you obviously recognize those mistakes. Is there a way to make it so the best technology does get funded, or is that just an unrealistic notional hope of fools like me?
Well, that's what the private equity firms are doing now. They're rolling these companies up. But just before we lose that point, I mean, I see it over and over again, especially in ag tech. The company that's made inroads with the markets are the ones that get funded. The ones that have the relationships with the agronomists so they can go up and sell the product to the farmers, they get funded, because the view among the investment community, I will tell you, is that, look, we'll figure out the technical solution. We'll buy it. We'll acquire it. You know, we'll develop it, you know, but getting the markets, you know, getting the users, that's a different kettle of fish. That's much tougher. So I think that scientist that you're talking about with the really good idea, they need to have somebody with domain expertise. They need to have somebody on their team that understands agriculture, because it is a much different industry than other industries.
Yeah. One of the problems with the investment in that space is investors, historically, in the tech investment space, they know that in 3 to 5 years, it's going to be doubling in value every year. It's going to have explosive growth and all this stuff. In the ag tech industry, things do not happen that quickly.
That's for sure. It doesn't. And that was the rude awakening for a lot of the VCs that got in and expected to exit, you know, in their normal amount of time. And it just takes longer. It takes longer for ag tech companies to grow. It's a longer term play. So we see angels much more active, or I do anyway, and private equity, course. But for VCs, if they're going to do it, and there's plenty of VC funds around that are focused on this, you know, some of them are my clients, but they just need to understand that this may be a longer hold than they're used to.
So for an investor, one of the challenges is, you know, you put money in to get more out later, and the rate of growth is sort of core to your success, right? So with interest rates getting up into the 5-6% range, you know, you have to invest in something that's generate returns more than that, you know, or that much just to break even, right? So, yeah. So if your annual return, if it takes longer to exit and you don't have an exit that's comparable, it's just a better investment and a better liquidity investment to choose something that's going to grow quickly and allow you to get out. So, you know, what's the difference in these investors and their notions and understanding of the world that causes them to say, I'm willing to get less return over a longer period of time with higher risk by doing something in ag tech than by doing something in, well, these days, AI, right?
I think that these investors, they see the potential. They see the potential upside and how much room there is, because there still has not been a lot of consolidation in this industry generally. There's still a lot of room for people to go out and take their particular vertical, to take their part of the market. And whoever does is, you know, they're going to do really well. And you know better than I do, the venture model, you know, you're not looking for those marginal little percentage, you know, gains. You're looking for home runs, right? You're looking for 10x and 100x or whatever. So,
well, so the average return for angels is something like 24% internal rate of return. And for venture, it's about 11.7. So venture is looking at 3x in 10 year and angels looking at 9x. In 10 years. But as the exit times grow, you know, those expectations drop down. The other thing that they all must realize at the angel level is you need a statistical investment approach. You need to have 30 or 40 companies in your portfolio to get the average return, even if you look at them carefully. Whereas in the venture space, they tend to invest with the idea of not losing money. And when you get into, you know, the private equity space and the family offices and so forth, they're looking for wealth preservation. So they have different strategic approaches, right? So yeah. I'm sorry, keep going.
Well, no, right. And what I've seen, so there's a lot of pressure in the market right now. Interest rates are high. That's limiting the amount of people that might want to put their money into a venture fund or even an angel fund, because they can get a pretty big coupon now, right? What is it, 6% treasury or something?
Well. So the other side of that is that, the venture market, investments in startups or whatever they call startups, which in some cases are 10 years old and have, you know, $500 million of funding, not what I would call a startup. But the investment rates have gone down by 50% in the last year, and they were down significantly the year before that. So it's sort of drying up related to those interest rates. And then there are other, you know, issues in the political system that we won't talk about. So that's, you know, you talk about investment, which has to drive all this stuff forward. And ag tech has had a tough time of it. And the tough time has to do with investors wanting this sort of, well, look, it's a better return. So most of the investors that I've seen that actually go into this space are people with ag backgrounds, right? So you get Roger, you know, he grew up in that space. So most of the people, you know, they have a lot of money. They maybe, you know, own football or maybe stadiums, but teams, right? And people that are, you know, big folks from universities in the ag part of the world and successful farmers and other growers and such. They're the ones that tend to go there. And I think it's fascinating that the technological advance is translating into something that at the end of the day is absolutely necessary. Right? There's no chance human beings are going to survive as a species without investment in these areas. And yet, you know, these other folks are investing in the newest AI deception technique, the technique that allows my online rapid, almost instantaneous sales to happen faster, the mechanisms that allow frauds and such to be more successful in defrauding people. Good investment. The tobacco vape space, which, you know, grew from almost nothing into billions and billions of dollars, basically making a better, more addictive delivery for nicotine.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, so they'll invest in that, but they don't have anything about the, you know, the benefit of humanity in mind. Anybody that's into environmental preservation should be looking at ag tech, right?
Well, so this is, you know, you asked the question to start that, you know, what do we do?
you know, this is the better innovation, better technology ends up winning. And my answer is finish engineering, right? It's easy to be an engineer, scientist, whatever, and say, I found this way to do this thing. And that's maybe entirely true. But, you know, if the that's the device to do the thing. If your question, if what you're trying to solve is, how do I solve this global problem? Then you start looking at policy, you start looking at economics, start looking at financing. Where does the money come from? How, what's the growth rate to put funds into this to get it to a point over time to achieve that goal? And it's not a compromise. They're not saying, oh, you know, I've made the better mousetrap, but I have to make a commercial, so I'm going to make it worse. No, the mousetrap is one problem. Solving the global mouse problem is a different problem. That second problem, and you know, to your comments just now, this is where tax policy and so forth comes in place. You know, you have to have, you know, social groupings, nation states or whatnot, say for us right now, this ag tech, you know, our subject right now, has worth beyond, you know, the calculations of the financial markets. Therefore, we're going to adjust public policy, right? You know, there's tax grants or whatever it is, right? So that, You know, investors aren't bad people. You're just sitting there with your family's money and saying, I can put it there or I can put it there. Right. And that is what it is. That's the physics of economics. But unlike the physics of physics, we can change the physics of economics with policy.
It's interesting that you say that. So the problem with policy changes is, at least in a democracy, policy change really involves influence operations, right? Large-scale influence operations to change the decision-making of the voters that ends up changing the people that are in positions to then act on their behalf at the local, state, and federal level. And then those folks make the policy decisions that then roll back downhill. And these processes are long. On the good side, ag tech is long, so maybe they're well matched to each other. But you know, every year there's a farm bill, and largely what the farm bill does is pay for people not to grow things.
Right.
Although increasingly there's a lot of emergency funds going to farmers because of, you know, drought and floods and so forth. Right. So if just some of that money got redirected to the R&D in the space, the returns could be outstanding. And that's something that government can do. And frankly, I think government has a role, right? So individuals, investors, and so forth, especially people just going after finance, not people looking, with a dream or, shooting after windmills or something. Investors have to focus on their own return over a relatively short period of time. And government can focus on a much longer term picture.
Right. And this is the, whether it's, it's funny, the challenge of democracy is that's how democracy works. You have to convince each other, right? You know, these influence campaigns can be good or bad. I mean, you can lie to people, and influence them to do things, or you can, have a point you think is true and look at, again, the physics of the society around you and say, all right, here's how people are, where they are, what they're thinking. If I could convince them, here's the argument that would convince them. And it's true. The nice thing about truth is, it's just lower energy to maintain.
Yeah, you don't have to remember so much to keep stating the truth. But apparently lying, you don't have to remember either. You can just tell different lies all the time and people don't remember long enough to care.
Well, in the disinformation space right now, we have an asymmetric battlefield, right? This is not the normal static state. We basically have little to no immune system and lots of tools for nefarious actors. But that won't stay that way forever. It's just
the question is whether we'll get over a threshold to where those bad actors are in fact in charge, and whether it stays that way for forever or not, it'll come out in their favor. I have this theory from long ago that in World War II, if the Germans had anything like the information technology we had even in the 1970s, the whole underground movement would not have been able to succeed. Right.
Well, it may be so, but again, in that case, their opponents would too. So the question comes down to who would use it better. And this is, you and I thought through this in a nation state infrastructure 25-year context, right? As I looked at that and some of those arguments I used working with that client, with that nation, the people there, is that at this point in time, in the foreseeable future, if you don't have some information, some, cognitive security processes in place, you won't be able to operate your life. You won't be able to know that the people sitting there at the console keeping the lights on in a city don't turn it off because they believe that it, you know, something untrue, you know, that a meteor just landed or whatever, right? You know, so it's not just about, you know, social, you know, political conflict. It's about pragmatic things. That's one of the reasons I think this, you know, I'm not happy with the state of things, but I know we'll move towards an end to this, you know, asymmetric state, because at some point you can't run water systems, right? It's not just about what we see. It's fundamental.
No, I think dictatorships can run water systems without a problem.
Longer topic, but the disinformation, this disinformation load is not a stable state. Right?
That reminds me, Chris, and I think we should mention this, coming up probably next February, there'll be probably a new major conference talking explicitly about these issues, and it's something that we should be talking about and pointing towards over time.
Tuesday, July 18th, go to Angel, present your company, get on the show, and make a fortune, or not. For more details or to sign up, follow the link on thecybershow.co.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're talking here with Jennifer Bayuk. Jennifer was one of the first chief information security officers on Wall Street and has a long and storied career before and after that.
Jennifer, welcome back. At some point, you started, you're getting your PhD, and I suspect before then, but at some point, you started to come to understand much more about risk management and the fact that there are trade-offs. And so tell us about risk management. Tell us about the evolution of your understanding of risk management from when you started out until after you got your PhD. And then, of course, we'll want to know what you did next.
Okay. Well, I'll start with management metrics at Bear Stearns, because management metrics at the time for security management were overwhelmingly verification that we built the system as we planned. We assumed that our plans would work. And so we were verifying that.
And how did it work out?
Configured properly. We actually didn't have too many problems as long as we, stayed. There was an analogy back then of the guys who were hiking and they saw a bear. You know that one?
Yeah, the bear in the woods. Yeah, I don't have to outrun the bear. I just have to outrun you.
Right. So that did well for us, you know, keeping the operating system secure as per the Center for Internet Standards, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so you weren't able to make it as secure as you would like it to be, but you were able to stay ahead of the bad guys sufficiently so that the losses were reasonably mitigated, right?
Yes. And of course, every loss is followed by remediation and improvement project. So that particular thing never happens again. It will be a variation that is at the next level, unexpected, but the cutoff for what somebody can get away with is lower, right? Because we've got those segregation of duties and things in place and whatever happened.
So that's just a small diversion from here. So for example, you know, in the financial world, there's a threshold of permission for anybody to do harm to the company, right? Uh-huh. So you can't write a check of more than this much money without somebody else approving it, right? Uh-huh. In cybersecurity, we have people that run, for example, the network or that do the patching, and they don't have thresholds. They're just allowed to run the whole network or patch all of the systems, which means that the aggregation of risk is way above the financial threshold for somebody at that level. Have you seen anybody fix that?
Yes. I was jumping ahead a couple of years, but...
The yes will do for now. Let's continue with your story, and then we'll get to the yes.
Okay. So... I was consulting ever since Spare. I had to actually do some real projects to get my PhD, some research projects. So I was lucky enough to know some CISOs of places like Deutsche Bank and Morgan Stanley, who let me analyze their security problems and create metrics that will help them manage those problems. And
security metrics.
Yes.
Now let's talk about Metricon and Mini Metricon. Okay.
Yes. I had started with metrics prior to Metricon and was one of those people who are frustrated by not having standard security metrics. So started creating them myself. And Dan Gere was actually a Bear Stearns consultant in the IT group at the time. And he had started Metricon and he invited me to go.
Metricon was after Mini Metricon, right?
Yes. Well, did you start Mini Metricon?
Well, we started Mini Metricon.
Okay.
Mini Metricon was started at an RSA conference where we had that discussion and said, well, let's have another one next year, just before RSA. Great. So we set up something at University of San Francisco where we could all meet, and, you know, management analytics sponsored. I think we probably paid $200-$300 to sponsor it and brought drinks for everybody.
Yes.
And, you know, that started to evolve into Metricon to try and develop those metrics. Yeah. So continuing on. All right. So you're developing metrics and you're doing this for the big financial institutions. Okay. But as a consultant. All right. So yes. Keep going.
Yes. So I was able to publish and do very interesting things while I was getting my PhD. And when I finished with the PhD, by the way, I was also teaching system security engineering for Stevens by then at the time, and going out and doing projects at
Stevens Institute of Technology.
Yes.
Yeah, not everybody knows when you say Stevens. It could be just your friend, you know, Joe Stevens. Oh,
Stevens House, right. Okay, so Stevens Institute of Technology, their claim to fame, for people who don't know Stevens, is they were shipbuilders and steamboat builders and sailboat builders and, you know, big engineers back in the days of Carnegie Mellon. The Stevens brothers and Carnegie Mellon got together to create some universities so that they could get people who are technical enough out of school to manage factories. So Stevens, as Stevens had three sons, and they also were avid racers, and they challenged Britain to a sailboat race, which is called, was named for the winner. The Stevens brothers won the America's Cup, first ever, right? And it stayed in America for many years after that. And that's another long story. But so it's an engineering school, really, really top-notch engineering school. Systems engineering was where they were interested in security most at the time when I was there. The computer science department just wanted to deal with cryptography. I wanted to deal with what was happening out there, practical, real systems. And
because cryptography, there's the mathematics of it, which nobody really bothers to break for the most part because you don't have to.
Right. So that's why I ended up in systems engineering. And it was a really good experience. And I was able to use, as I said, the consulting, but also they sent me out to teach system security engineering to places like Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, you know, these DOD contractors that had money to spend on what they called cohorts, right? To get.
Yeah, I remember I ended up teaching in one of those. Thank you very much.
Thank you for sitting in for me. I remember that. And, you know, I don't blame you at all for the students walking away saying Fred doesn't agree with the PowerPoints that you wrote. But,
well, the truth is the truth.
Right there at the end, there's a little Fred story.
Just one of many. Yep. So
those slides are bad. I'm not giving them.
No, I gave them. I just, you know, I commented on them.
Yes.
But so one of the things that I really enjoyed there was the Bear Stearns. She's talking about, you know, Bear Stearns, you know, staying, you don't have to stay ahead of the bear. You have to stay ahead of the other guy. Right. And that's what Bear Stearns' approach was. Apparently, Bear Stearns couldn't stay ahead of the bear, and that's how they got wiped out.
Yeah, that was interesting times. I was running the picks team at Cisco, and Bear Stearns was one of our big customers. And, yeah, all of a sudden, it got complicated.
At least.
Huh. Yeah, 2000, the big crash. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, it was that was their own fault, and Jennifer warned them about it. So it's not like they shouldn't have known. They should have known. And
well, you know, it's interesting. In the last time we were talking about this, you know, so exactly as we were discussing, right? You know, she said, okay, you know, risk aggregation, and you know, just as you do in your normal process, you're a financial company. You know, does somebody have the authority to press a button and cause you to cease to exist as an organization? Right? Kind of important to know that. Right?
The CEO is authorized to do that. The chief risk officer told them, and the CEO said, okay, I understand, and we're going to do it anyway. And then the button got pushed, right? All right. So, but the answer, of course, is the CEO has that authority, but probably the guy that runs, you know, the update mechanism on the endpoints should not.
Right.
So, but we got a yes. Somebody has figured out how to do it and done it, but I don't believe it. We might see about that coming up. So in any case, you know, clearly she got to the point where she's getting her PhD. She's teaching courses at an engineering school. PhD is in systems engineering. and she's also working in Wall Street. You and I are doing more than one thing at a time. And I just want to reflect on the fact that apparently a lot of good people seem to do, you know, they get bored with merely having one full-time job and getting a PhD at the same time. You need something else to keep you engaged.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies. Next week on The Cyber Show, David deals with massive ship and cleans it up. Roger does diligence and diligence does him back. Jennifer gets full-time at consulting rates. Another pitch strikes, we'll see. More fraud, spies, and lies, and a whole lot more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time at Bow. A good time at Bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time at Bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.